This is the Infotagen podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. Disinformation and other harmful content often attracts more attention online than mainstream news and information. Social media companies like Facebook and YouTube make money from ads when people spend time on their platform. Also, alternative news websites often rely on ads to fund their work. For many marketing brands, this creates a jeopardy that their messages may end up alongside content they wouldn't want to be associated with. In this podcast, we'll be discussing the responsibilities both of social media companies and advertisers to act against disinformation and hate speech. I'm Damien Collins, and today I'm joined by Imran Ahmad, the founder and CEO of the Centre for Countering Digital Hate. Also, Chris Stokel-Walker, a tech journalist and the author of YouTubers, How YouTube Shook Up TV and Created a New Generation of Stars. And we'll be hearing from our resident expert, the disinformation analyst, Dr. Charles Creel. Imran, it's great to have you on the Infotagen podcast. Now, in the last few weeks, your work's been causing quite a stir, both in identifying disinformation around COVID as well as hate speech online. And I've been really interested in the work you've been doing targeting advertisers, asking them not to fund sites and pages and that fund and support the spread of disinformation. And you seem to have incurred the wrath of Donald Trump Jr. and Steve Bannon. So tell us what's been going on.
Well, thanks, Damien. Yes. Well, the Centre for Countering Digital Hate, we transitioned all of our teams to work on coronavirus very early on, so at the end of February, beginning of March, because the spaces that we were observing, and we typically look at identity-based hate and spaces in which anti-Semites, Islamophobes, racists of all kind, and bigots of all kind spread their creed. And that's primarily Facebook groups, on Twitter, in darker spaces. And we're constantly tracking. What we'd seen was a rapid pivot and instrumentalization of coronavirus to back their agendas, whatever it may be. And we saw that with the rapid use of hashtags like Corona Jihad, which the CCDH identified as coming from the Hindu nationalist right in India. And was actually adopted by the British far right, the hooligan right. And so we saw this rapid transition to coronavirus. We started studying it. And as part of that, while we were studying coronavirus, funnily enough, what we noticed was the coronavirus crowd suddenly instrumentalizing Black Lives Matter as a way of saying, well, of course, if all these black people are able to march, then there can't be a virus. And we saw them embedding hate narratives in there as well. And, you know, there's particular examples of super actors who work across a number of different misinformation and hate spheres. People like David Icke, who's come out really vehemently against the COVID vaccine, against the idea COVID exists. He's an anti-Semite and Islamophobe. We already knew that. Now he's one of the leading campaigners against Black Lives Matter. So we decided to look at the fake news sites that are normally proselytize hate, have been talking about coronavirus for a few months, and now are pushing anti-Black Lives Matter narratives. And we came up with a simple campaign, which was that loads of companies have come out in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. And we suggested to them that if they are genuinely in solidarity with Black Lives Matter, perhaps they don't want their adverts appearing on websites which preach anti-Black Lives Matter narratives. And the reason that's happening is because Google Ads take their money and they say, I'd like to have 500,000 people see my ad. And Google, without telling them, places those ads all over their display network. And Google have tolerated for far too long on their display network some of the worst offenders when it comes to hate and misinformation. So we normally just put pressure using Stop Funding Fake News on the advertisers. We correct a market failure. We show them their ads appearing on the wrong sites and places that don't align with their brand values. And they normally react by going, oh gosh, I better take this off. But this time Google actually took action, which is unprecedented, against two sites. First, Zero Hedge, which is one of the world's biggest misinformation and hate sites. And it's in the top 500 or so websites, not news sites, in the world. And Google took all of its advertising down once our campaign had launched. The second was that there was a website called The Federalist, which Google initially told NBC, who we'd given the exclusive story to, that they were going to defund. But then they'd forgotten, and that The Federalist is actually owned by Meghan McCain's husband, sort of Republican royalty. And of course, the Republican right, Ted Cruz and others, came out straight away and virulently in defense of The Federalist, which is a horrible site, and, you know, has done things like excusing paedophilia in the Roy Moore case, saying that, you know, underage girls is not so much of a problem. That has spread COVID misinformation, that has spread identity-based hate narratives. And we found ourselves suddenly with the guns of Donald Trump Jr., Steve Bannon. In fact, Trump himself tweeted about it. So that was quite an experience, but we were pretty certain in our case, which is that they kept saying this is about freedom of speech. And we reminded them that brands have freedom of speech too. They can decide where they want to advertise. And the alternative is ludicrous, that you could force a brand to advertise on a website which carries material that is completely antithetical to their own brands and their stated values. So an interesting week.
Absolutely. I think there are several really interesting issues in that. I think the first one, I think, looking at the decision that Google have taken, because I think that shows sometimes people think, well, you know, in America, they have the First Amendment. It protects free speech rights. You can't really arbitrate on speech. But here we see a big company taking a decision, you know, that they disagreed so fundamentally with the work of a particular website, they were prepared to defund it from their ad model. And that, Jonathan, that stands in quite stark contrast to Facebook's decisions to not intervene in making decisions like that. And then as a consequence, being happy to still make money out of sites that spread hate.
Well, it's a really good point. And what has happened is that all too often the social media companies themselves, which have enormous lobbying arms, have elided the First Amendment, which is there to protect from the whim of a capricious and cruel state that tries to ban types of speech, which I think most of us would agree is not a good thing in a liberal democracy like the UK and the US. With forcing companies to do business with whomsoever comes along, even if it's antithetical to their brand values. And I think that, and in doing so, to essentially negate their terms of service, because their terms of service say, we won't do business with people who fund terrorism, where there's child sexual exploitation, where there's identity-based hate, where there's deliberate disinformation which seeks to harm people. And in the case of coronavirus, let's be dead straight. The lies on those websites cost lives. Because if people are being given the wrong information, if they're being persuaded not to take the precautions that are recommended by the health authorities in each of our countries, it will cost lives. And I think what's been really interesting is Google, when the pressure was placed on them, and the only pressure placed on them really was a moral case that we put forward, that if you yourselves have given $10 million to Black Lives Matter organizations because you say that you support that movement, then how on earth are you taking $10 million a year from these 10 websites which preach anti-Black Lives Matter narratives? When that moral case was put to them, I think they did the right thing initially in saying, you're right, we made a mistake. We should have enforced our terms of service. And they took action. It was in walking it back on the Federalist that they joined Facebook and their ilk, who really have been incredibly resistant to enforcement of their terms of service, and only do so when it's highlighted by people like yourselves, Damien, people like ourselves at the Center for Countering Digital Hate, who are able to marshal public relations, the news media and others to bring attention to these moral failings on their part.
Do you think we're getting to a bit of a tipping point here on this issue? Because it's been very interesting in the last week that we've seen it's quite major brands, North Face, Patagonia, Ben & Jerry's, who've pulled their advertising from Facebook in July. Do you think more companies are starting to take this issue seriously now?
I I'm an optimist, Damien, and so I will tell you that, yes, this is a tipping point, but I'm also, I'm paid to be a realist by the organisation I run. But I think that we will need to sustain that pressure and keep a laser-like focus on the responsibility of the social media companies, that they are perfectly aware that they are fueling division, that they profit from hate. And let's not forget that they earn profits from hate, because in many respects, their algorithms are designed around engagement, and division and divisiveness are key to engagement. That's what keeps our attention, a good ding-dong, rather than a bunch of people going, I agree with you. And so that really powerful dynamic at the heart of their business models, I think they're starting to realize is fundamentally flawed.
And of course, they've known this for a long time as well. I was very interested to read the Wall Street Journal reported on the internal Facebook studies, I think from 2016 and 2018, which showed that the majority of people that join Facebook groups that are spreading hate or extremism do so at Facebook's recommendation through the algorithm.
That to me was fascinating, because it really, they identified a technological problem that was causing a moral failing, and they have a technological solution. So they'd come up with a technological solution to that problem. However, they did not have the moral courage or inclination to push forward with solving the moral problem. So they have a technological solution. This, you know, they always fall back, as you'll know, on, we need to fix the algorithm, we need to fix our policies. But they know darned well that their system is fueling division, that it fuels extreme voices at the expense of voices of moderation and tolerance. And they have failed to take the action necessary, which is technically possible, for them to fix that moral problem.
Yeah. I just wanted to come back to something you mentioned at the beginning as well, which is that looking at network disinformation networks moving from subject to subject. So people that have engaged in other issues in the past, moving on to COVID, bringing in Black Lives Matter as well. And that to me suggests that these are organized networks that operate on a continuous basis. Because if this was organic, it was just people talking about things that they were interested in, you wouldn't see these clear links that are clearly there. But it seems there are people that whose job every day is to try and sow division and hate, no matter what the topic is.
I think this is a really chewy subject, and I love discussing it with people. The question of coordination, to me, what underpins all of those themes that comprise the radical worldview, and you'll know as well that on these websites you find a constellation of views which can seem, that their connection can seem abstruse, climate denial, anti-vax, men's rights / incel movement, identity-based hate, and we see them coexisting in these spaces. And I mean, I've argued that what underpins all of them is an anti-elite, a conspiracist, and a faux populist mindset. And those three elements together, which are underpinned as well by, they're brought into cohesion by a centripetal force, which is that they all argue that we're in constant competition for scarce resource. And that sort of brings the urgency to it. You can see people being brought in through the men's rights movement, but then being inculcated in a wide range of beliefs. And I think that's partly because they have a fundamental philosophical core to them. I think second, it's because those actors are very opportunistic and are constantly looking to each other to collaborate and cooperate with each other. But I think as well that there are exemplars, and that Breitbart is one example. That's a US example that has all of those elements in there. Another example is a super actor like David Icke, who has every single one of the elements that I just talked about within his own the material that he preaches. And so it's a complex system with nodes who act as aggregators, and they help to shape that philosophy and shape the sharing of ideological strands. Is there a grand conspiracy? Well, as someone who specifically campaigns against conspiracy theories being proselytized, I don't think so. I don't know. But I'm certain that these phenomena do far too often to be random come up in the same places at the same times with the same actors.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us for this discussion. I'd just like to follow on the conversation about advertising on social media and brands looking to pull their advertising from social media if they feel that it's being put alongside messages of hate, or indeed whether the advertising is supporting organisations that don't share their values. Do you think we may be coming towards a point where brands are going to become more vocal and companies like Facebook and YouTube are going to have to respond?
I do. I think we really are, Damien. And the reason that I say that is that we have prior precedent. So we can talk about the certain 2020 issue with Patagonia and Ben Jerry's and the North Face and them kind of pressuring Facebook, who to my mind seem completely out of lockstep with the rest of social media and pretty much in a little bit of problems here. But you know, we can look back 3 years and see exactly the same issue with YouTube. So April 2017, The Times puts out a front page story that says essentially washing up adverts have been served alongside terrorist recruitment videos, IS videos, what was called or to become called the adpocalypse for YouTube. So that first kind of very negative story snowballed. You started to see advertisers putting a little bit more pressure on YouTube. I mean, I know obviously through the Select Committee, you were doing huge amounts as well to try and pressure YouTube through a sort of political regulatory sense. But generally, social networks, I think you've probably found with sad experience, they don't do a lot unless their bottom line is threatened. So in YouTube's case, they had the threat of really big advertisers like Procter & Gamble and others deciding to pull their money, and eventually that kind of jolted them into action. And it is notable, obviously we're recording this on sort of June the 25th, it's notable that Procter & Gamble have been reported to be considering their positions in terms of social media advertising budgets.
Absolutely. And I think it is, you're right to reference that with YouTube, because they did move and change. And they've moved on a few other aspects of policy as well. I mean, your great book, YouTubers, I think, gives a brilliant analysis of the way the platform works. But they've got rid now of micro-targeting for political ads, which you can do on Facebook, but you can't do on YouTube now. And they reformed the advertising rules to make it, you know, it's only films that have got a bigger audience that get advertising now, to make it less likely it sits against extreme content. And of course, last year they decided to take down the Nancy Pelosi deepfake film, which Facebook didn't do. I mean, how do you see their different approach? Do you think they can see the way the wind is blowing and are trying to move there before, but Facebook are still very reluctant to do that?
Yeah, well, you know my position on this. I am relatively big tech skeptical, despite the fact that I cover this space quite a lot. I personally think that you have to drag these social platforms kicking and screaming to do any sort of action. So with my cynical hat on and having seen, you know, some of the performances from YouTube executives in particular and a few other social platforms in front of your committee in the past, I think that they are very willing to move, or to be seen to be moving rather, but less keen to do significant action. There was a really interesting debate between one of the committee members about a year ago when you had YouTube in front of you versus YouTube's lawyer, who was basically talking about responsibility versus liability. So, no, I think YouTube are, to their credit, actually doing something about this eventually. As you say, they are starting to take significant action, and responsibility has been one of their watchwords. And we're also seeing that with Twitter, but obviously Twitter is kind of coming up against the opposite problem, which is they are highlighting issues and drawing a line in the sand over Donald Trump's tweets, which are kind of causing them to be dragged into conversations about what is and what isn't acceptable. So I think pretty much anybody can say when the looting starts, the shooting starts, is probably an incitement to violence. But Twitter's had issues in terms of highlighting other tweets of Trump's and saying that they are unacceptable on their platform, which actually, you know, people in the center ground of politics have said, well, hang on, actually, you're maybe overstepping the mark here. So it's a difficult one. And yeah, you've had experience with Mark Zuckerberg, so you probably know far better than I do you haven't had experience with Mark Zuckerberg. But yeah, you probably know better than I do about Facebook's stance on this. But I do worry that they are kind of standing out in the wrong way here.
I think that's right. And I think I think sometimes they use a very simplistic sort of free speech defense to say, well, you know, under free speech, under the First Amendment in America, we can't, even if we wanted to, we couldn't do anything about this. Where I think that's just not true. And we see that other American companies are making calls on this content. And it's interesting, I think, the way Joe Biden has sought to make it almost an election issue as well about responsibilities the tech companies have. And I think one of the key things is that because these are not organic systems, when you go onto YouTube or Facebook, you don't just see the last thing of the person that you follow most recently uploaded. You see, you're directed towards content by the platforms. And I was quite amused with YouTube in particular. I think I read out to them the stat you have in your book that 70% of what people watch on YouTube is selected for them by the platform, which has clearly come from a YouTube briefing to the tech press, but they wouldn't even acknowledge publicly when asked about it.
Yeah, well, and this is the scary thing. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I have, a lot of the conversations I have with people in these tech platforms is by necessity off the record or on background. But, you know, I've had interesting exchanges with some of the people who are in charge of designing and maintaining these algorithms, you know, the computer code that serves us up what it thinks we're interested in, where they kind of get most of the way to saying that they don't themselves fully understand how it works. And when I say, well, what is the solution to that? Because obviously, you know, you've had a lot of debate with these platforms about human moderation and the importance of that in terms of nipping in the bud this kind of problematic content. Their solution is a very uniquely Silicon Valley tech bro one, which is, oh, well, to fix the malfunctioning algorithm that we've built and currently have, we're going to build another algorithm, and we're going to have this kind of weird robotic inter-algorithm war where nobody really understands how they work, and we just hope that the good guy wins.
Yeah, absolutely. But and I think what there's growing awareness of now is that these problems have been created largely because of the fact that these two very big social media platforms, YouTube and Facebook, are designed to make money from advertising. And so therefore the algorithms are there to hold people's attention for as long as possible so that you can serve as many ads as possible against them. And it doesn't necessarily have to be like that.
No, it's all about the attention economy. And you will know better than anybody else on the front line of politics, Damien. We are in a very different world because of these social networks, in my opinion, at least. I think, you know, we see a highly polarized political society, and, you know, there are 101 different reasons as to why that is the case. But some part of that is because these social networks are trying to kind of filter us into tribes and serve us more of what we want and often kind of entrench our views. And, you know, I do feel sorry sometimes for the social platforms because they are getting it from all sides. And I think I've said to you, obviously, the work that you and others are doing in the UK is in parallel with the work that people in the US are doing and work in India and Europe and elsewhere. But you know, these social platforms are kind of getting it from all sides. And I do feel sympathy for them up to a point, because then I remember that they have been partly responsible for the kind of, you know, conundrum in which they are in, where there is no good move for them. You know, if they come down on one side or the other, they're going to alienate 50% of the population who are really pretty entrenched in their views. And I always wonder, like, what would happen if they had decided to step in earlier, if they decided to step in sort of 5 years ago when people were first raising concerns and we were in a very much more politically forgiving environment?
Well, I think that's right. And I think change comes too slowly. And I think in particular, I think there's an area of form, I think, looking at YouTube in particular, I'd be interested in your views on this, which is that, you know, we still often use in sort of governmental terms or parliamentary terms We talk about the internet as being a sort of discrete thing, you know, separate from broadcasting, separate from everything else. But actually, that doesn't really reflect the user experience. The latest Ofcom survey of media consumption in the UK shows that for all adults, YouTube is the third most popular broadcast channel. But yet we don't regard influencers on YouTube, you know, the YouTubers with huge audiences, we don't regard them as broadcasters. They don't come under the broadcasting code. But maybe it's time that people that have very big audiences on social media, that have special responsibilities that go with that, that are similar to the responsibilities that are being created for people that broadcast on the radio or television.
Yeah, and I think that this is part of the problem is we have almost let these platforms get so big that they are, you know, to some extent kind of unable to be monitored or unable to kind of be regulated. I mean, and this is where I really don't envy you and your colleagues, because, you know, it's very easy for me to kind of sit at the sidelines and throw a couple of bricks into the fight every so often. And I don't have to come up with solutions. But, you know, I found it very puzzling that while I agree there needs to be some sort of regulatory solution, the idea of getting Ofcom, who, you know, have an employee base of 1,000 or even less, I think, at the last check, to try and regulate platforms like YouTube and Facebook, who employ tens of thousands of community moderators and still aren't able to do it properly, is a real concern. So, you know, this is the point where I fully fess up and say that I don't have an answer to this problem, to be honest, because I wish I did, but I just don't see any good solution.
I think I wouldn't often pray in aid of the banks, but I think there's an interesting parallel between the way banking is regulated and what we could do for technology, in that banks are required to monitor for fraudulent activity, money laundering, and so on their through their systems. You know, and banking is, you know, powered by technology. It's complex. It's international. There are multiple different products available. But we all know that, you know, you get a, if your bank thinks you've made a payment that is unusual or out of character or from a location that is new, you might get challenged to prove that it was you who did it. And if there's evidence of money laundering, they should hand it over to the authorities. And the banks are punished if they don't do that. Well, there's no such liability for tech companies. If something bad is happening on their platforms, well, if someone finds it, then they'll take it, they may take it down. But they're under no legal obligation to find it for themselves. And I wonder if we need to reverse the responsibilities here, rather than it being the job of a regulator to discover all the things that are going wrong. We create legal liabilities for the platforms to be more effective in policing themselves and then be held to account if they fail.
I mean, my interesting follow-up question to that in terms of being a journalist is then, well, how, you know, at what level do we set those fines? Because, you know, you look at kind of what exists already for the banks, and it's often, you know, chump change for them. And even when we're talking about Silicon Valley companies, I think that they are factors bigger in terms of their business. So it is a really difficult one to do. I think absolutely there needs to be, if not buy-in, then there needs to be an element of the stick alongside the carrot to try and compel the platforms to do a little bit more than they are currently doing. Because at the minute, you know, they all focus solely on attention, which means money for them. And generally that means a very hands-off approach to regulation and moderation. But you know, it is a difficult one, because I mean, at some point you have to try and make the fines proportional, but also make them meaningful. And I guess follow through on the threat. So you look at, you know, the British Airways ICO fine of, what was it, 186 million or something like that, which is a very big number, but it actually, in theory, will never get levied against them. So it's difficult. You know, I don't know, social platforms are supranational as well. You know, if you look at the sad reality is, though, you're an elected politician in a country and certainly hold an awful lot of power in that space. Mark Zuckerberg is more powerful probably than pretty much every elected politician there is.
But I think that the companies have to abide by the laws in the countries where they trade. And I think that's, for me, was one of the interesting things when we looked in the Select Committee at what's happened in Germany, and the fact that the German hate speech laws are applied online and tech companies can be held liable for content that breaches those rules if they don't remove it. And on the whole, the companies have tried to comply. They've introduced more content moderators and they've respected the fact they have to comply with the law. But I think some of the level of fine, you're right. I mean, it's got to be, if you're going to find a company like Facebook, it's got to be meaningful. on data protection rights, it's 4% of GDP of turnover, of the annual turnover of the company for breaches of GDPR. But we've yet to see an enforcement of a fine of that size.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? The threat is always there, and it's kind of looming over them and looming over any company. But the challenge, particularly with GDPR fines, is that they are often announced as big headlines, but you dig a little deeper and there's no follow through. But I agree 100% in terms of this kind of challenge of making sure that there is a meaningful response. And I think the way that we do that, and I know you've been trying to get kind of an international agreement across this sort of stuff, is people and governments in particular are stronger together than they are apart. So the ability to kind of band together and say, well, rather than having piecemeal regulation on salacious content that relates to particular societal issues in India versus, you know, in the UK, in the online harms white paper, which is looking, I guess, particularly at kind of fake news and disinformation in the US, the election coming up, obviously that is focused very much on politics. Rather than having, you know, individual countries kind of just kicking at the shins of these social platforms, I wonder whether or not it's a good idea to try and band together and come up with some kind of global rules that apply to all, that is like a sort of minimum viable product that we can then approach the platforms with and say, well, you know, these are the rules of the road worldwide, you stick to them or we're not using you.
I think it's an interesting point. I mean, one of my concerns about like global solutions that often gets referred to is that sometimes that can be used as an excuse not to do anything. But I think we were talking about this with Jim Borselli, the former CEO of BlackBerry, on the podcast recently. And he said he thought there should be like a Bretton Woods type agreement for tech, in the same way that after the Second World War, the Western countries got together to agree a way in which they would organize their monetary policy. Whether there needs to be something, some broad principles on tech as well, in terms of where we think the company should be liable, what we think they should do, and certainly an agreement that they shouldn't have sort of blanket immunity from any liability from what happens on their platform.
Yeah, well, because I think, you know, I appreciate the difficulty of, you know, even getting people within a single country to agree on something is nigh on impossible. So then you multiply that with the however many countries we have across the world, and trying to get some sort of agreement is difficult. But even if it is a baseline upon which you can have a country by country additive basis, because, you know, there is the risk, and we haven't seen it yet, but I always do worry that there is the risk in a country by country legislation regulation model that you sometimes have internal contradictions. And, you know, if you're the social media platforms who already are kind of trying to keep politicians at an arm's length away from their business, it's just an easy way for them to say, well, we're not going to build 50,000, well, not 50,000, we're not going to build 150 or whatever it is, different versions of our product based on 150 different regulations. So, I mean, you'll have thought about all of these things multiple times. And I just kind of, you know, I'm a journalist. I come at these from a very facile, pick them up and drop them the next day ideas. But it's a really interesting one to kind of think about, as to lots of the models that we seem to have tried so far aren't being as effective as we want them to be. So what are the alternatives?
I'd like to, at this point, just bring in Charles Creel, who's with us as always and been listening in.
Amen.
Good to have you with us again, Charles. What have you been looking at in the last few days?
Well, I've been looking at a White House disinformation story, and it's kind of led me down a rabbit hole of thinking about disinformation in general. This week, the Trump administration called out four separate Chinese media organizations for their operations in the U.S. They're making the case that the media outlets are controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, and they've designated them as, quote, foreign diplomatic missions, which is bad. A couple of things stand out here. First is understanding precisely what they mean by foreign diplomatic mission. It's a relatively benign sounding nominate, but in fact, that's, it's not a problem with foreign diplomat. There's not a problem there in general. There are entities from one state present in another, but representing their home country, like a diplomat or an embassy. But the issue here is that these organizations are calling themselves press while they're actually functioning as representatives of the Chinese Communist Party. And that kind of brings me to my second issue with this. Because this announcement came from Trump's White House, I found that I immediately doubted it. My first thought was that the stream of White House disinformation is so full that even announcements around political positions I might agree with, and that's the case here, I immediately find them suspect. And this is a foundational technique of contemporary propaganda and worth looking at. You fill the information and media stream with so many stories, half-truths, and outright lies that the public no longer knows who to trust or what to believe in. Not the mainstream press, not the alternative press, not the government, not the opposition. Now, how would this possibly benefit the White House? Well, it's a technique that's promoted by Steve Bannon, flooding the channel with, let's say, rubbish, which is not to say that the story is rubbish, but the point is you can't tell if it's rubbish. It's also a foundational technique of Vladislav Surkov, who was Putin's man when it came to disinformation operations, both at home and abroad. Surkov served various roles in Putin's government, from advisor to deputy prime minister, but he was seen as the main ideologist of Putin's Kremlin, responsible for keeping Putin's circle in power. The BBC filmmaker Adam Curtis talks about him and talks about how Surkov would have the Kremlin publicly support one side of a protest while financing the other side, but then letting everybody know that they had done both. And what that did is undermine any sense of reality in relation to government or to reality in general, and pretty soon nobody believes anything anymore. And now we find we're in a similar predicament to the Russians. In the same week that Trump has announced that much of Chinese media in the U.S. is CCP propaganda, he's also released a video that manipulated a CNN news report to show the opposite of what the report originally said. Now, this was that video about two black and white children who were friends, and Trump's video turns the white kid into a racist, chasing the black kid, and uses fake Chiron graphics to then tell the lie that it was a CNN report. It's also the same week that thousands of Gen Z K-pop stans punked the president's rally in Tulsa, even as his campaign office was claiming rioting outside the building was what was keeping the numbers low. And it's the same week that we've heard from John Bolton that Trump begged Chinese President Xi to help his re-election effort, and the two leaders talked about eliminating U.S. term limits. I mean, the channel is full. And from this White House, it's nearly impossible to know what to believe. But yes, they're CCP media outlets. Yes, Trump is lying. And yes, Vladimir Putin is having a great couple of innings right now.
Well, and it's, I think we're not even close to November yet. So it makes you wonder how this is going to hot up over the next few months.
Hot indeed.
You've been listening to the Infotagen podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Imran Ahmed, Chris Stoker-Walker, and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagen, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagen.com, or using #IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you. Until next time.